Today is Tuesday, June 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Democratic lawmakers say there are a lot of unanswered questions about a Russian bounty program in Afghanistan.
They actually didn't receive a lot of granular detail on these allegations because they were briefed by White House personnel and not by intelligence personnel.
Plus, China passes Hong Kong's national security legislation.
If we go by how the mainland treats voices of opposition, the outcome will be very bleak for a lot of activists in Hong Kong.
We'll have those stories and more next. New information casts doubt on White House claims the president was not briefed on possible Russian bounties offered to the Taliban. AP correspondent Mike Gracia starts us off.
The White House will be facing new questions today about classified intelligence indicating Russia was secretly offering bounties to the Taliban for American deaths in Afghanistan. U.S. officials with direct knowledge of the intelligence tell the Associated Press in early 2019, top officials in the White House were made aware of classified intelligence indicating Russia was secretly offering bounties to the Taliban for the deaths of Americans. According to the officials who spoke on condition of anonymity, the assessment was included in at least one of President Donald Trump's written daily intelligence briefing. The White House has said Trump was not briefed on the intelligence assessments because they were not fully verified. On Sunday, former National Security Advisor John Bolton said Trump is claiming ignorance to justify his administration's lack of a response. Mike Gracia, Washington.
After eight Republican members of Congress were briefed on this matter Monday, it's the Democrats' turn today. Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent, and I spoke with her to find out if these briefings are easing concerns on both sides of the political aisle.
Well, what the House Democrats were able to share with reporters up on Capitol Hill was that they actually didn't receive a lot of granular detail on these allegations because they were briefed by White House personnel and not by intelligence personnel. So really what we were hearing was that Leader Hoyer came out and said, look, this is no substitute for the all-members briefing the congressional Democrats have been calling for since the beginning of this week, since these reports came out. They are saying that intelligence professionals from the CIA, the National Security Council, need to come up to Capitol Hill and they need to talk about the actual intelligence involved in these reports so that members have a better understanding of the threats facing U.S. troops and how much President Trump knew.
Have they made any comments regarding reporting by the Associated Press, by information that they receive, that at least twice, according to AP reporting, the White House has included the information in presidential briefings?
That was absolutely addressed in the presser. They were talking a little bit about how any kind of information, intelligence information, goes through a vetting process, gets kind of a threat rating level, gets a level of how certain the briefers are that this is good intelligence. What House Democrats were telling reporters was that a threat of this serious nature, no matter how certain the briefers were, would have at least made it up to the presidential level so that the president could be aware of it when he got on the phone with Vladimir Putin. Of course, the president is considering readmitting Russia into the G7, G8. He would need to know something of this serious nature, this threat to U.S. troops in Afghanistan before he started making those decisions, whether that intelligence was signed, sealed, delivered, fully verified or not.
The Democrats met with White House officials today, but yesterday it was the Republicans' turn. What did they have to say after their briefing?
They actually were not speaking that much to reporters after they came back from that briefing. That was a handful, about eight House Republicans who went to that briefing. And we're hoping to hear more from them as the story develops. And we actually are seeing a fair amount of concern among congressional Republicans about these reports. Lindsey Graham, of course, has said that the president needs to take them seriously and that Congress will need to get to the bottom of this to assure the safety of U.S. troops.
And one last thing. You mentioned that there has been a call by several congressional members for a full congressional briefing by the intelligence community on this subject. Has there been any movement on that request?
So far, no, because we've been seeing these smaller briefings among House Republicans and among congressional Democrats. I would think that because there's so much outcry over this, we will eventually see briefers head to Capitol Hill. Of course, all of that will be complicated by the coronavirus pandemic.
Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent. China has approved a contentious national security law that would allow authorities to crack down on subversive and secessionist activity in Hong Kong. Hong Kong's sole representative on the Standing Committee of the National People's Congress has confirmed that the law has been passed. Reporter Ria Mogul is in Hong Kong, and she spoke with me via WhatsApp.
So we actually know absolutely nothing about what the law actually says. In fact, this morning there was a press conference where the chief executive, Carrie Lam, was asked what she knew about the law and whether she knew if the law had actually been passed. And she was unable to provide a single detail because she doesn't know.
Leading up to the vote, there was some discussion in Hong Kong, and Carrie Lam said that she had not viewed the legislation yet. Is that still what we believe to be true?
Yeah, so very few people, I believe just an absolute handful of people, had actually seen the law. And I don't think it was the whole law in its entirety. It was just little bits of it. You know, the only people that have seen it are the top officials in Beijing. So hardly anyone has really seen this law. And, you know, a lot of critics, a lot of human rights lawyers, a lot of activists are very outspoken and angry about this and critical about what this law will entail. You know, if we go by how the mainland treats voices of opposition, the outcome will be very bleak for a lot of activists in Hong Kong. And bear in mind, you know, last year's anti-extradition protests and pro-democracy protests has resulted in thousands of protesters behind bars. And what this means for them is to be seen.
What's been the reaction in Hong Kong after the announcement?
As expected, this law is having a very chilling effect in Hong Kong. You know, within an hour of the law being passed, Joshua Wong, Hong Kong's, you know, the face of Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement, announced on Twitter that he was going to step down from his political party. And following his announcement, three other members of his political party, which is called Democisto, three other members stepped down as well. And later in the day, Democisto announced that they had disbanded completely. You know, thousands of activists have deleted their social media presence. Activists are requesting media outlets to take down opinion pieces that are critical of China's government. You know, so everyone is very, very scared. Everyone's quite terrified and just sad. Everyone's, you know, just heartbroken at the events that have transpired today. That being said, a few pro-democracy activists have still said that tomorrow, so on Wednesday, which is the anniversary of the handover from, you know, Britain to Chinese rule in 1997, they said that they will still go ahead and, you know, march for democracy in Hong Kong.
Ria Mogul is a journalist living and working in Hong Kong. Reuters News is reporting that the new security legislation says that the crime of secession is punishable by up to life in prison. The U.S. National Security Council spokesman said Beijing's passage of the national security law is a violation of its commitments under the Sino-British Joint Declaration. As Beijing now treats Hong Kong as one country, one system, so must the United States. The European Union has excluded the United States from its initial safe list of countries from which the bloc will allow non-essential travel from Wednesday. The 27-member bloc gave approval on Tuesday to leisure or business travel from 14 countries beyond its borders, the Council of the EU, which represents the EU government, said. The countries are Algeria, Australia, Canada, Georgia, Japan, Montenegro, Morocco, New Zealand, Rwanda, Serbia, South Korea, Thailand, Tunisia, and Uruguay. China has also been provisionally approved, although travel would only open up if Chinese authorities also allowed in EU visitors. Reciprocity is a condition of being on the list. A Johns Hopkins University COVID-19 tracker counts the total number of confirmed cases at just over 10.3 million, resulting in more than 500,000 deaths. As the world continues to grapple with the current pandemic, the World Health Organization will read carefully a Chinese study on a new flu virus found in pigs. The study found the virus has become more infectious to humans and needs to be watched closely in case it becomes a potential pandemic virus. The WHO spokesman said the findings underscore the importance of influenza surveillance during the COVID-19 pandemic. Still to come in today's program:
the systematicity of the crime, the target, which is a special part of the population, the mixed race people in Congo during the colonial times, and the attacks, which is the harsh treatments given to those child in the time.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers at the University College London have developed an affordable therapy that can help people with decreasing eyesight due to aging. Glenn Jeffrey, lead author of a study detailing the discovery, says that as we age, especially after turning 40, our visual system weakens tremendously. Study authors found this decline is caused in part by an aging-related drop in the production of energy-producing mitochondria in the retina's photoreceptor cells. Without normal levels of energy, the cells are unable to function properly. The researchers learned that looking at a deep red LED light for brief periods of time boosts the cell's energy system like recharging a battery. They found after this treatment, color contrast sensitivity and ability to see in low light improved among test subjects aged 40 and older. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The European Union's most powerful member, Germany, takes over the bloc's rotating presidency in July amid a raft of challenges, from the COVID-19 pandemic and the economic devastation it has wrought to Brexit, trade with China, and tensions with the United States. Lisa Bryant has that story.
Germany's presidency comes as its leader, Angela Merkel, the European Union's longer-serving current head of state, is expected to leave office next year. Both she and the bloc have plenty on their plates. On the EU's immediate agenda is overcoming differences to push through an $843 billion coronavirus recovery fund aimed to boost a green economic reboot. Then there's getting agreement on the EU's next multi-year budget with a proposed price tag of more than $1 trillion.
Die Erwartungen sind hoch.
Meeting Monday with France's President Emmanuel Macron in Meissenburg, Germany, Merkel said she hoped the 27-member bloc would strike a deal on both at a July summit. The German presidency comes as Merkel is riding a crest of popularity, partly over her handling of the coronavirus outbreak. While Germany often sides with more frugal bloc members who are reluctant to offer large, non-repayable grants, Merkel teamed up with Macron to push for a massive coronavirus recovery package. The EU and Britain have also intensified negotiations aimed to define their post-Brexit relationship, with London eager to wrap things up speedily. John Springford is deputy director of the London-based Center for European Reform Research Institute.
There's a realization that she wants to have been a chancellor that has made Europe stronger. And so there was a kind of happy marriage of interests going on between her and Macron.
Sébastien Maillard, head of the Paris-based Jacques Delors Institute think tank, agrees Merkel is thinking about her legacy.
It's really a time for her to make history. So this presidency, yes, will surely make a difference compared to previous ones.
But making a difference doesn't promise to be easy. Reuters reports Germany wants more reciprocity with China following complaints by European companies of an uneven playing field when it comes to market access. Tensions between the EU and the United States have also grown under the Trump administration, which plans to withdraw thousands of U.S. troops from Germany.
I think a strong desire to have some strong relationship, because we know that we share many common values and that there is much for both economies to share together, but to really be treated on even terms, and for the US to consider the EU as a whole, not try to divide us.
But analysts like Daniel Gross are skeptical about just how far Germany can go as European Council president. Gross directs the Center for European Policy Studies in Brussels.
A presidency, especially of a big country, cannot achieve a lot. Because if a big country tries to push its own priorities, the others usually react allergically.
What's clear is there is plenty of work ahead for Berlin and for Brussels in the months ahead. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Iran has sentenced journalist Ruhollah Zam to death. Zam's online work helped inspire the 2017 economic protests. He had been living and working in exile in Paris before being convinced to return to Iran when he was arrested in October of 2019. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif are scheduled to address a U.N. Security Council meeting on the implementation of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. The Trump administration pulled out of the deal, and tensions between the two countries have escalated. A key issue at Tuesday's long scheduled council meeting is expected to be U.S. opposition to the lifting of a U.N. arms embargo on Iran in October. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu appears determined to carry out his pledge to begin annexing parts of the occupied West Bank, possibly as soon as Wednesday. His vision of redrawing the map of the country in line with U.S. President Donald Trump's Mideast plan has been welcomed by Israel's religious and nationalist right wing and condemned by the Palestinians and the international community. But with opponents offering little more than condemnations, there seems little to prevent Netanyahu from embarking on a plan that could permanently alter the Mideast landscape. Three Myanmar military officers were found guilty by a court-martial investigating atrocities against Rohingya Muslims in the conflict-ridden Rakhine State. The rare action against military members came as Myanmar faces charges of genocide at the United Nations' top court over a brutal 2017 crackdown against the Rohingya. Some 750,000 Rohingya fled to neighboring Bangladesh with accounts of widespread murder, rape, and arson. Belgium's King Philippe expressed deep regret on Tuesday for the suffering and humiliation inflicted on the Democratic Republic of the Congo during its 75-year period under Belgian rule. Earlier today, I spoke with journalist Nicolas Pinot in France via WhatsApp about the King's letter, which comes on the 60th anniversary of the African country's independence.
Well, King Philippe said, and I quote, "I want to express my deepest regrets for those wounds of the past, whose pain is weakened today by the discrimination still present in our societies." Now, you have to remember, today is the 60th anniversary of the Democratic Republic of Congo's independence, who was free from colonialism in 1960. So he sent this letter to the Congolese president, and he wanted to really said that he will combat all forms of racism, and said he wanted to encourage the reflection on this issue. Now, it's very important to mention that he expressed regrets, but he's not apologizing on behalf of what the king, Leopold II, did in what was called back in the time the Zaire, the former Democratic Republic of Congo. I think also what you have to be important, because the king in Belgium wouldn't make any of these comments without the agreement of the government. And as of today, the Prime Minister of Belgium, Sophie Wilms, she said the time has come for Belgium to embark on a journey of truth. And she also support the comments for the king, and she said, and I quote, "All work of truth and memory begins with acknowledging the suffering of the other." And she also announced that by October you will have a parliamentary mission to really look into the crimes of the past.
Speaking of crimes of the past, there are currently five biracial women who were born in the DRC while the country was under Belgian control, and they filed suit in Belgium because they were taken away from their parents. One of their lawyers, Christophe Marchand, has called it a crime against humanity.
The systematicity of the crime, the target, which is a special part of the population, the mixed race people in Congo during the colonial times, and the attacks, which is the harsh treatments given to those child in the time.
What do we know about this lawsuit?
Well, we know that these five women were born between 1945 and 1950, and they filed this lawsuit because basically they were born during colonization, and their fathers were white from Belgium, and basically they abandoned them. And to cut any link between their roots with Belgium, basically the state of Belgium put them in an orphanage, in a remote place in DRC, where they were basically taken care by religious sisters. But after 1960, they were abandoned, and they had to really raise them, grow up themselves, you know, and they had to take care of each other. And you had also violence, and they talk about some violence by local militias. So what they want the government of Belgium to acknowledge is that it was part of an organized policy to deal with those kids, because basically, and that's part of the lawsuit, is saying that Belgium has organized the fact that these kids had no roots with Belgium to claim citizenship and the benefits of being a citizen of Belgium.
Reporter Nicolas Pinot spoke to us from Paris, France. Carl Reiner, the creator of The Dick Van Dyke Show and a driving force in American comedy as a writer, director, and producer, has died at the age of 98. The legendary comedian's assistant, Judy Nagy, says Reiner died of natural causes in his Beverly Hills home.
Can you make a one-minute film on your mobile phone? Do you want to try? Join others who are sending in 60-second videos to the Mobile Film Festival Africa. Films can earn cash grants, and there is grand prize of 10,000 euros. Some films will be featured on VOA programs. There is one specific rule. Participants must live on the African continent. Submission deadline is July 7th. Find out more and submit your film, visit www.mobilefilmfestival.africa.
You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
What is good for Asia is good for the United States, noted Gloria Steele, Senior Deputy Assistant Administrator for the Asia Bureau at the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. Our goal in Asia, she explained in a recent interview, is to help them become prosperous, free, and open, and help them to achieve self-reliance. USAID was particularly successful in helping Vietnam improve their competitiveness by increasing transparency and streamlining business practices in the country, said Ms. Steele.
Vietnam is now one of the highest growing countries from an economic perspective in the region. They have demonstrated the highest increase in terms of the WEF's, the World Economic Forum's competitiveness ranking in the region. And that has had significant impacts for both the people of Vietnam in terms of quality of life, as well as markets for the U.S.
In Indonesia, USAID has been instrumental in advancing the energy sector, said Senior Deputy Assistant Administrator Steele.
We have been working with Indonesia, particularly in the energy sector, and they have been able to work to make their policies such that there is a lot of changes and improvements in modernizing the energy sector. Again, this has served as a good source of investment, not just for local investors in Indonesia, but for the U.S. investors as well.
In the Philippines, USAID has supported the growth of e-commerce with an investment in mobile banking, which has enabled people who do not have access to banking services to use their mobile phones to manage their finances. It eventually developed into a system of e-payments, which are used not just for commerce, but for distributing social welfare services for the disadvantaged and marginalized in the country. USAID will continue to help countries in Asia become economically self-sustaining by creating conditions that encourage private sector investment. Senior Deputy Assistant Administrator Steele said USAID plans to work with governments to make their policies so that they're conducive to private sector involvement and there is a level playing field for legitimate private sector entities.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.